The COVID-19 crisis has shaped the way we speak about medicine and health. The phrases social distancing, flatten the curve, and asymptomatic spread, among others, have become part of our everyday language. And while coverage of vaccines and the latest variant dominate the news cycle, the public is left to believe that there is no effective treatment for COVID-19. However, prominent medical professionals have shown that early treatment is not only possible, but it is the best option for preventing death of COVID-19.
The current program that's supported by the Minority Witness and the National Institutes of Health and all government bodies is that patients go home, they get no help whatsoever, doctors are not supposed to treat them, they go out in a panic to urgent cares and ERs, contaminate more people, and then they're hospitalized and die. America has to wake up right here, right now. We are getting buried and we need home treatment.
Was it the widespread fear that prevented doctors from treating patients? Or is it the public health agencies' focus on a vaccine? I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and joining us today is Dr. Peter McCullough. You may recognize Dr. McCullough from his testifying on the Senate floor about the COVID-19 crisis, the vaccine, as well as early treatment. But today, Dr. McCullough joins The Last American Vagabond to speak with us about the government's response to this crisis, and in particular, the conduct of the CDC and the FDA. Dr. McCullough, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So before we get started, can you tell us your medical credentials and qualifications and background in medicine?
I went to undergraduate at Baylor University in Texas and then medical school at University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas. And I was an Alpha Omega Alpha graduate. That's in the top 7% of the top 50% of all medical schools in the United States. I went on to University of Washington in Seattle and trained in internal medicine. I did 3 years of rural practice to pay back my student loans, and then went on to the University of Michigan School of Public Health, received a master's degree in epidemiology, and then did my fellowship at what is now the Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine in Michigan. I've held a series of leadership positions over the course of my career in Southeast Michigan, Kansas City, and now in Dallas, Texas, where I've returned home to finish my career. And I'm the current editor of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, Cardiorenal Medicine. I'm the senior associate editor of the American Journal of Cardiology, one of the oldest journals in cardiology. And in my field, which deals with the interface between heart and kidney disease, I'm considered the most published person in my field in history. I have over 600 peer-reviewed publications cited in the National Library of Medicine. And I really dropped everything when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. And I focused hard on this with a series of opinion editorials that were published in The Hill all the way through the year. I was a regular contributor. I have over 40 publications now in the National Library of Medicine concerning the pandemic, including two important papers that teach doctors how to treat COVID-19 to prevent hospitalizations and death.
Can you talk about treatments for COVID-19?
Well, the treatment of COVID-19 became really the pivotal issue, because we realized there were two bad outcomes, hospitalization and death, and it became clear that the hospital couldn't save all the patients, including today, even after all we've learned in more than a year, those who require the ICU, at 28 days, the mortality is 38%. It's unacceptably high. It's one of the most fatal diseases once a patient is hospitalized. So it's clear the hospital is too late. So in my view, it was the most important a focal point to intercept patients early, as we would with any other infection, and then apply treatment.
Let's talk about the COVID-19 vaccines. Can you explain to us how this vaccine, the gene-based vaccine, differs from our traditional vaccines?
The majority of vaccines, we have over 70 available for different conditions, and many hundreds of millions of injections are given a year. The vast majority of vaccines are considered inactivated, so they're simply an inactivated protein that the body responds to, or they're live attenuated, meaning the virus is alive, but it's been weakened, so it can't cause any damage to the body. And then there's a few vaccines that are against bacteria, and I think the listeners would recognize that tetanus, for instance, is a bacteria, and we give some tetanus protein in order for the body to respond to it. I know the listeners at some of these interviews are just overwhelmed. It's almost like drinking from a fire hose. But in brief, COVID-19 ushered in an entire new generation of vaccines that use brand new technology. So they're not, in a sense, inactive proteins or disabled viruses, but they're different technologies. So whether it's messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA, which causes the body to produce the RNA, the active issue is the fact that there's RNA, ribonucleic acid, and RNA is what proteins are transcribed from. Proteins are made from RNA through an assembly called a protein synthesis through ribosomes. And so what we know is that these vaccines come into the body, they are distributed, and then as the messenger RNA or the adenoviral DNA is taken up into human cells, it tricks the human cells into making a protein. And in this case, the protein that's made in COVID-19 is the spike protein that's on the surface of the viral particles. So the listeners would recognize these cartoons of the virus, which is like a ball with spikes on it. The vaccine makes the spike. The spike protein was made to be very strong, and it made the virus more contagious, and it made the virus more deadly. So for the first time in human history, we're having the body make a potentially deadly protein. And then that protein circulates in the body with the hope of creating immunity. So as you can imagine, just by the mechanism, there's great concern that as this lethal, potentially lethal protein circulates in the body, in some people who are susceptible, either the quantity of spike protein could be too high, or the duration of circulation could be too high, or the frailty or the susceptibility of the patient could be such that the vaccine could indeed cause harm. So there's immediate concern that those who've had prior COVID-19, their body is already revved up, ready to make spike protein. That could cause harm. And in fact, that's been shown in three studies. There's great concern that people prone to blood clotting could actually have the spike protein cause blood clotting, because that's what it does. It damages blood vessels. It causes blood clotting and elevation of inflammatory proteins. And there's also great concern that it could damage certain populations that weren't studied, like pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, the very frail in nursing homes who weren't studied in the registrational trials. So just out of the gate, as describing this landscape, it's a landscape of concern over safety.
Is it better to achieve immunity through transmission in contracting COVID-19 or through vaccination?
Well, natural immunity is far better than vaccinated immunity. There's no question about it. In fact, every other infectious disease that we know of, the natural immunity is better than vaccinated immunity, except with respect to tetanus. Tetanus may be better with the shot than the natural infection. But having said that, we know on all scientific grounds that the natural infection is better than the vaccinated infection. It makes sense. You get exposed to the whole virus. So we have an explosive library of antibodies, hundreds if not thousands of antibodies against the spike protein, against the nucleocapsid, against different mutations in the spike protein, defense mechanisms against polymerase, all the other viral enzymes. We get T cell immunity. We have T helper cells, T presenter cells, natural killer cells. Those cells have thousands of changes in them to recognize the virus, and then present that virus to a B cell, turn it into a plasma cell, make antibodies. That immunity is robust, complete, and permanent. And every single evaluation shows the natural infection immunity is terrific. So I've always said to a young person, let's say a person your age, it's a blessing to get the infection and get the natural immunity. You can't get COVID twice. It's just a wonderful thing. Now, the vaccine creates a limited immunity just against the Wuhan spike protein. Remember, I mentioned this product of bioterrorism, the Wuhan spike protein. That's what patients are developing an immunity to. And it's a limited library of immunity. The thought is it's about 50 antibodies that are generated. Now, the concentration of those antibodies are high, but it's extremely limited. The T cell immunity, what we're seeing in the data there, it may be 10% of what someone gets with the natural infection. And we know the vaccinated immunity is not complete because we've already had thousands, over 10,000 breakthrough cases because of the underreporting, it may be 100,000 breakthrough cases. So we know the vaccine immunity is, in a sense, faulty, that patients can get the infection again. And then we also don't know if the vaccine immunity is durable. We know the antibodies trail down over time. And if the cellular immunity is not robust, which it's not, then I would infer that after 2, 3, 4, 5 months, the vaccine provides no benefit. And our vaccine stakeholders, I think, tend to agree because they're already talking about boosters. You know, we started the program in December. A lot of people are vaccinated in January, February, March, April. They're already talking about in the fall, a few months from now, boosters. So the vaccine stakeholders don't think the immunity is very durable, at least from reading those messages. But this idea of, you know, fully preventing a brand new respiratory infection, we don't do that. We do influenza vaccine, but the influenza vaccine, don't forget, is changed every year based on the mutation of a variety of vaccine targets. And we accept that the vaccine, influenza vaccine, is only partially effective, maybe 40 or 50% effective. And the thing about all vaccines is important to understand is the vaccine is only to prevent the infection in the person getting the vaccine. So the reason why I'm a healthcare worker, for instance, and it's a regulation that I receive the hepatitis B vaccine, that's to protect me against a workplace injury, let's say a needle stick, and I would contract hepatitis B. Okay, so that vaccine is for my purpose. It's required at my workplace to get the influenza vaccine. Okay, so I get it. That's to prevent me from getting influenza. Let's say a senior citizen is brought in, I'm trying to examine them, they cough in my face, and I get influenza. The influenza vaccine is to protect me. Okay, for COVID-19, I think the thinking is, you know, let's vaccinate children or people who we shouldn't vaccinate in order to protect others. And this is very, very dangerous thinking, because here, let's say we vaccinate a 6-month-old baby who has absolutely no risk of COVID. We're asking that baby, who can't make an informed choice, to take all the risks of the vaccine for someone else's benefit. We've never done that before. We're actually seeing signs and symptoms of it. There have been 80 colleges that have announced that they're going to mandate vaccination of the students. Many of those colleges are not mandating vaccines for the faculty. So the students who really don't have any meaningful risk of COVID-19 are being asked to take the risk of the vaccine for the benefit of the faculty. We've never seen this before.
So for example, my vaccination status does not impact another person's health.
Right. Your vaccine status is your own personal health information. It's protected by HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It's nobody else's business whether or not you've taken the vaccine.
Can you explain to us how this vaccine has been tested, and as well as its authorization for use under the FDA?
The traditional methods and acceptable methods for a vaccine registration involve 24 months of rigorous testing. So the vaccine has to move through a variety of testing stages, including testing in cell-based cultures, animals, and then onto humans. All that was truncated with the Operation Warp Speed, the Vaccine Alliance worldwide, and there became vaccine stakeholders, the World Health Organization, Gavi, the Gates Foundation, the CDC, the FDA, and then the manufacturers, which range from Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, J&J, BioNTech, and there'll be more manufacturers. The idea here is that there's an alliance to try to band together and combat the pandemic with mass vaccination. And so the vaccines were accelerated in terms of their development, and they were tested over the course of 2 months. So what we know in humans is that we only know that once vaccinated, fully vaccinated, we only know 2 months of information in terms of what happens. Does it prevent COVID-19? Does it not? And all the trials uniquely showed that the rates of coming in contact with COVID and developing COVID over those 2 months are less than 1%. So that's an important point for the listeners. When they get a vaccine, people go out and they think the room is filled with COVID, or the shopping mall is filled with COVID, or the sports stadium. But in fact, that's not the case. The chances of ever getting exposed to COVID are less than 1%. And as the pandemic rates go down, we know that, in fact, those overall exposures become less. And indeed, in the clinical trials, it was less than 1% for even someone who received COVID, even someone who received placebo. And so this idea that the vaccine is going to be this universal protection, I think, is misperceived by the public. The vaccine will have less than a 1% impact on the epidemic curves. The analyses by Dr. Brown in Canada, my interpretation, all are congruent that the vaccine will not have an impact on the COVID-19 pandemic. What it may do, though, is it may provide assurances. It may provide a reduction in this fear that we've had over the course of a year, and people may feel better that they've done something to protect themselves against COVID-19.
Dr. McCullough, I'm sure many people watching right now are perhaps fearful of either COVID-19, the virus, or they are fearful of this new vaccine. Can you explain to us the risk-benefit analysis of receiving the vaccine versus contracting COVID-19?
Well, that's a great question. As we sit here today, roughly half of Americans have been fully vaccinated. And the vaccine centers started really declining in terms of interest by the public starting April 8th, and most of them are very inactive now. In fact, vaccine centers have been closed down. So we're really at that 50-50 split that you've mentioned. So what's holding back in terms of the vaccine program? It really has to do with this evaluation of risks and benefits. So below age 50, there's less than a 1% chance of hospitalization and death with COVID. And there's still less than a 1% chance that COVID would ever be contracted. So below age 50, it's very hard to justify any safety risk with a vaccine. It just can't be justified because it's such a less than 1% calculus. Over age 50, then the risks come over 1%. And in fact, they're progressively higher as individuals get older. And we know COVID-19, let's say in an 80-year-old, COVID-19 has over a 20% chance of mortality and a 40% chance of hospitalization. So you can see the age gradient here in terms of risks and benefits. If we take the end of the spectrum, which would be ages 12 to 15, the data were recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, May 27th issue. This was the Pfizer registrational trial. Here, 2,300 children ages 12 to 15 were either vaccinated or received placebo in a 2-to-1 relationship. What we know is the vaccine, the net impact of the vaccine is it prevented 14 cases of a very mild illness, almost like 14 cases of a head cold. There were no serious cases. There was no report on spread to the family, and I assume it didn't occur. And we know that 60 to 80% of the kids on shot number one or shot number two became quite ill. They reported fevers up to 40 degrees. A third or more required the parents to give Tylenol or something to bring down the fever, joint aches, muscle aches, nausea, vomiting, difficulty breathing. So the net analysis was not favorable for the vaccine clinically. Now, the vaccine did cause a rise in antibodies, and by that metric, it was approved by the FDA for emergency use authorization. That doesn't mean it's safe and effective. It just means that it can be offered for elective utilization if the parents wanted to do that for their children. On the other end of the spectrum, in, let's say, seniors, people at very high risk, they weren't included in the registrational trials, but the registrational trials coming out of the gate for adults looked pretty good. It looked safe over 2 months. And I can tell you my practice, and I do use vaccines in my practice, I've received all the evidence-based vaccines myself, that about 70% of my patients were vaccinated in December, January, February. But as the safety data came in, it started to become apparent that the vaccines are not risk-free. And we don't have, with the vaccine program in the United States, we don't have a clinical event committee, a data safety monitoring committee, an ethics committee. We don't have the standard structures we need for clinical investigations. And I think that's worrisome right now. The public should realize we don't have the safety safeguards that we had in the registrational trials. In the trials that were done by Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, they actually did have those committees and they were actually able to manage safety. Now in the current program, it's completely elective. The public is asked to sign a consent saying, listen, we don't know if this is going to work and there may be serious safety side effects. including death. So in the seniors over age 50, the calculus starts to run in favor for all the vaccines combined in the United States per year that's reported into the safety database. And most of the reports are done by doctors and by nurses, let's say within 30 days of the vaccine. The total number for many hundreds of millions of shots is about 200 deaths per year get reported. They may not be related to the vaccine or not. The regulatory authorities really don't care. They just want to, you know, have the safety reporting. With a COVID-19 vaccine, just after 5 months and about half the public vaccinated, we have over 4,400 deaths reported in the VAERS database. And several days ago, the CDC upgraded that to 4,800 deaths. And there may be a considerable lag in reporting. So I fully expect that we're going to exceed more than 5,000, maybe 6,000, maybe more deaths. In Europe, they have over 10,000 deaths. These deaths are concerning. About 40% happen in days 1, 2, and 3 after the vaccine. There's been no analysis by external unbiased review panels for causality. But I can tell you, as a citizen and as a doctor, I can't ignore these numbers. I'm genuinely concerned.
In a normal situation, would you stop vaccinating people if it resulted in this amount of deaths?
Well, we have an example from the swine flu pandemic, 1976. Great concern regarding this. We had 220 million people in the United States. We vaccinated about a quarter of them, 55 million. There were 500 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is ascending paralysis up the legs, and 25 deaths. And that was thought to be unsafe, and the program was shut down. For a typical drug that gets on the market is FDA approved, at 5 deaths, there's in general a black box warning when we can't explain what's going on. At 50 deaths or more, typically the drug is pulled off the market and some type of review is done. So we've exceeded all guardrails for safety in terms of mortality. And it's not just mortality. With the vaccines, there's been over 14,000 hospitalizations. Again, we know over 80% of these are reported by doctors and concerned healthcare workers. We know that there is a preliminary CDC VAERS number, and then the information reviewed, then it's vetted, then it becomes a permanent number. So the numbers I'm giving you in this interview today, these are permanent numbers that have been vetted by the CDC. Over 4,400 deaths, over 14,000 hospitalizations after vaccination. This is unprecedented in medical history.
It's unprecedented in medical history.
It's never happened before. It far exceeds it. Again, all vaccines combined every year in the United States, and the number is about 200. So it's been said that the COVID-19 vaccination program, just vaccinating half of Americans, we do more than that with the flu shot, but vaccinating half of Americans, that we've exceeded all deaths and hospitalizations for all vaccines, including the flu shot, over all years combined. I mean, one could make the claim that this is the most unsafe vaccination program in the history of America, and certainly the history of the world.
In a previous interview, I spoke with Dr. Roger Hodgkinson. He's a pathologist based in Canada, and he told me that this is politics playing medicine. I know that you have had some experience speaking with politicians and leaders about treatment for COVID-19. Can you talk about your experience?
Well, it's been said that when you mix medicine and politics, you get politics, and that's probably true.
Dr. Xi's testimony is reckless and dangerous for the nation. And his comment regarding the poison control reporting is exactly what Dr. Peters is interested in. You're interested in misinformation regarding COVID. That report in the middle of the pandemic, when hydroxychloroquine early on was appropriately used, that first wave of the pandemic, that's what kept it from rocketing, skyrocketing.
Since the onset of the pandemic, and based really largely on my work and with respect to getting an early treatment response, not only in America or the world, and we've made great strides. You know, early treatment reduces hospitalization and death by 85%. We have major medical organizations, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, the Frontline Critical Care Consortium. These are major groups now providing guidance, treatment networks, access to medications. This has been a huge push since the U.S. Senate testimony, November 19th and December 10th, led by Senator Ron Johnson. I give him a lot of credit. So that's where politics and medicine really came together with the U.S. early treatment effort. That cleared out the hospitals, reduced new hospitalizations and death. It basically got control over the pandemic. There were predictions that we were going to be over 2 million deaths in the United States. It's really kind of rounded out between 600 and 700,000. The only people who die today or get hospitalized are those who receive no early treatment. So the big news is early treatment works. The bad news is that the politics and medicine intermixing has been just a terrible thing. So for instance, none of our political leaders, none of them, presidents, White House Task Force, NIH, CDC, FDA, WHO, EMA, NHS, none of them have ever made this statement. And the statement is, hospitalizations and deaths are the two bad outcomes of COVID-19. You know, getting a cold at home is not a big deal. But if you get hospitalized, or in fact, if it's a cause of death, that is a big deal. The goal would be to reduce hospitalizations and death. The only way to do that is to come up with a program to treat sick patients at home to prevent hospitalizations and death. None of those government agencies, none of those incredibly powerful political factions have ever made that courageous statement. It's almost as if they've had an oblivion to the sick patient with COVID-19. Of interest, Steve Kirsch has put out an offer on the internet and said if anybody in the CDC, NIH, FDA, WHO, if any of them can make the case that they've done anything to prevent hospitalization and death with early treatment, he'll give them $2 million. And nobody's come forward. It's really a stunning revelation.
Are we deviating from the typical procedure and protocol here?
We've deviated massively from the procedure and protocol. If we had a rash of staphylococcal infections, we would race forward. We'd give antibiotics early. We'd find ways of dealing with this. If we had an outbreak of some type of gastrointestinal infection or urogenital infection, we'd race forward. We wouldn't block the administration of antibiotics. We wouldn't penalize doctors for trying to take care of patients. It would be all hands on deck. So the deviations from normal are tremendous. The public health agencies and major medical centers offering no early treatment for patients. Major medical centers not even trying. They didn't even try to come up with protocols of new drugs or putting old drugs in combination. They didn't even try. The government agencies doing no early treatment research of any significant impact. Doctors, in terms of their care, denying patients early treatment. This is a stunning thing. So if a patient called in and said, you know, I have a bladder infection, I'm worried about it going to my kidneys, that doctor would prescribe antibiotics and get going. But if another patient called in and said, I got COVID-19, the doctor would say, sorry, I can't help you. You know, this type of a dichotomy and deviation from practice is extraordinary. I think out of great fear, everyone deferred to our agencies. So our agencies became more powerful. And this emergency use authorization was both good and bad. The agencies initially put emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine, a very valuable drug that we use in combination for COVID-19, but just for inpatient use. So it was effectively a restriction. And then when the research showed, were small trials, but the research trials initially did not show a signal of benefit on randomized trials for hydroxychloroquine, then the FDA put out a warning saying don't use hydroxychloroquine at all. And so the real valuable use of hydroxychloroquine was in the outpatient realm, and that put a chill on using hydroxychloroquine. And what we found out over time is that the viral infection, because three components are important, viral replication, inflammation or cytokine storm, and thrombosis or blood clotting, what we learned is that if we address all three elements of that with a combination protocol, that in fact we can reduce hospitalization and death. But the protocol doesn't depend on any single drug. So hydroxychloroquine became a lightning rod. And then later on, ivermectin became a lightning rod. People say, well, those drugs didn't work. And there was a lot of arguments. To this day, patients are denied hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. It became so politicized in some countries. For instance, in South Africa, Dr. Chetty, who's a doctor of quite a reputation in South Africa, learned how to treat the illness with no hydroxychloroquine and no ivermectin. He treats the inflammation with a combination of steroids and inhaled steroids, aspirin, an allergic drug called montelukast, and then blood thinners, sometimes injectable low molecular weight heparin. But importantly, we found out that there were many ways to in a sense, skin a cat. What the disappointment was is that we did have an emergency use authorization in the United States, and they did bring technology to treat patients. We had initially offerings from Lilly and Regeneron, which are emergency use authorization of infusion of monoclonal antibodies against the virus. So if we could catch it early, we could have a big impact. And your listeners may recall that President Trump received one of these infusions. Rudy Giuliani received one of those infusions. But what Americans became frustrated with is there was no messaging on how to get access to these infusions. There was no public health messaging. There was no flyers or information given at the time of someone who got a COVID-19 infection. It almost seemed like the messaging from about the summer till now was absolutely overwhelmed with the vaccine. And the vaccine doesn't apply to sick patients. Sick patients need treatment. And so to this day, poor Americans are scrambling with no health information, no hotlines, and really no access to these important monoclonal antibody infusions. Just last week, GlaxoSmithKline got an antibody infusion approved for early infusion in the hospital. And again, there's no announcement of this. There's no word of this. The public is blinded to this. And sadly, 80% of these products sit on the shelves unused. So I think the emergency use authorization has not been equally applied for treatment as it is for vaccination. The listeners would realize that we're hearing vaccination morning, noon, and night, but we never hear about treatment.
Well, the thinking is that if there was an effective treatment, that you would not need a vaccine. So I have to ask you, is this all about the vaccine?
I think, reading the tea leaves here, I think there became a love affair with the idea that we could use the vaccine as really the solution to a global problem. And that became an intellectual stake, almost certainly a financial stake, a political stake. It became such a union of these drivers that before we knew it, vaccination, which started out as an investigational elective offering, only demonstrated in basically healthy adults, not tested in COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, had no evidence of benefit in children. Suddenly, this became a sociological weapon within about 4 to 5 months, and we started hearing about vaccine passports and people losing their jobs, people being threatened in terms of their education and their future trajectory based on the vaccine, restrictions in travel. None of this was supported by the science. None of this was supported by the clinical trials. The agencies that actually offered these in the United States, it was the NIH, the CDC, and the FDA. They're the stakeholders, if you will, from a governance agency perspective. They made this an elective offering. We've been told that these agencies won't ask their employees to get the vaccine. So it's so interesting that these are offered as an elective opportunity for individuals who want to take the risk and do it by these agencies. And then quickly schools, employers, and others have mandated these without honestly, the governmental support of the mandate. The government does not support any mandates. The science is not strong enough to support the mandates. In fact, we've seen before the CDC stopped reporting it, we saw 10,000 breakthrough cases of patients fully vaccinated in the United States who developed COVID. 9% had to be hospitalized, 3% died. It looked just like the regular COVID.
So after someone got the vaccine, they were still getting infected with the virus. Is that what you're saying?
So the vaccine did not work 100%. And it's very important for Americans and worldwide people to know. So this idea of having a passport seemed kind of ridiculous, where the only people who can't get the infection again are those who've already had it. So COVID recovered, if you're going to build a passport system, it would have to be according to who's COVID recovered, right? So COVID recovered can't get it and they can't receive it. But instead, COVID recovered are ignored. And those who got the vaccine would get some type of privilege. And so the joke we had would be that if you're on a plane and you have all the vaccinated people, they can cough and give the COVID-19 to each other, but it's really the COVID recovered that are the ones who are immune. So I'd say put the COVID recovered in first class, put the vaccinated back in coach, and let them give each other the infection.
A lot is unknown about these vaccines, especially the long-term side effects, but can you speak about how it can possibly impact fertility?
Well, we simply don't know. The FDA and the vaccine manufacturers were very concerned about fertility and very concerned about pregnancy. You know, so much so that they excluded pregnant women and women of childbearing potential who couldn't guarantee contraception from even getting exposed to the vaccine in the registrational trials. So if women who are young and they're in childbearing age or pregnant, if they're thinking about the vaccine, they should understand that they were not eligible for the trials because the agencies had to justify those exclusion. And there's only two ways to justify an exclusion: that A, they don't think the product is going to work, or B, that they think it's going to be unsafe. So when they justify these exclusions to the FDA and the ethics boards, it had to be because they thought the products were unsafe. So if the vaccine stakeholders think it's unsafe at that level, and now it's offered, I think women who have a perception of what's going on should understand that these products, in fact, may not be safe. What we know from the registrational applications, and we only have pieces of it, in the Moderna application to the European Medical Agency, they were required to disclose animal fertility data. And with the Moderna vaccine, it did drop fertility. The number, as I recall, was about 16% reduction. And the threshold for not letting the product move forward would be a 25% reduction. So it didn't hit that threshold, but still down. And then the Japanese data were recently released, a biodistribution study that Pfizer did. And the previous thinking that the messenger RNA vaccine stays in the arm, that the spike protein is generated in the muscle of the arm, it turns out that was false, that the animal study with lipids, that were just like the lipid particles that are given in the vaccine, the lipids distributed in the body and went to the organs that we expect and the quantities we expect, except for the ovaries. And in the ovaries, over 48 hours, they began to concentrate there tenfold. All the organs go down, except for the ovaries go up over 48 hours. So, you know, just piecing all this together, it's concerning that the lipid particles are concentrated in the ovaries, that we know the messenger RNA, we know it produces the spike protein, and it's produced locally in these cells. So it's going to be produced in ovarian cells. And we know the spike protein is in the cell and in the surrounding tissue. We know it's dangerous, that the spike protein damages and destroys cells. It destroys blood vessels and causes blood clotting. And the only safety signals we're able to interpret right now are rates of menstrual irregularities in women, vaginal bleeding in postmenopausal women. These reports are coming in. We can't really interpret them without having some analytic framework. There hasn't been transparency from our agencies on female health. The same is true for miscarriages and stillbirths. Postmenopausal vaginal bleeding that could have been reported after the vaccination may not be related to the ovaries. In that case, the ovaries are relatively inactive in a postmenopausal woman, but it may be due to direct uterine damage due to the circulating spike protein. So we'll have to see more clarity on these reports at this point in time. So we haven't had transparency from the Centers for Disease Control on safety. That is, we need lots of analyses. For instance, there should be deep dives on obstetrics and women's health analyses, vaginal bleeding, postmenopausal bleeding. When does it happen in relation to the vaccine? On the first injection, second injection, by certain brands, by certain ages? Does it happen in patients who've had prior gynecologic malignancies, as an example? I mean, there's lots of analyses that need to be done because what we need to arrive at is we need to arrive at risk mitigation. How can we make this program safer? We still have half of Americans who are trying to figure out if they are going to get the vaccine. And then we have the looming possibility of booster programs. So once we move into booster programs, people are going to want to know, listen, is this going to be a compounding effect over time? The only thing we know so far is from when it's messenger RNA vaccines in the United States, Pfizer, Moderna, from the first shot to the second shot, all the side effects are amplified on the second shot. So people are greatly concerned that what about a booster? Is that going to be even a greater risk in terms of side effects as the body amplifies the production of this dangerous spike protein? we know that administering an investigational product in a pregnant woman that has never been tested before and it's not thought to be or proven to be safe to begin with, we know that violates a golden regulatory approach and a golden clinical approach to the pregnant woman. The pregnant woman is always held up as our most vulnerable patient because there's a fetus who can't make any decisions for him or herself. And so the only things that are allowed in pregnant women are safe medications and proven safe vaccines. And it's only the inactive flu vaccine, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis all inactivated. In clinical practice, if a new injection came available in clinical practice and they asked me, Dr. McCullough, do you want to inject your next pregnant woman with this injection where there's no evidence that it will help and there's no evidence that it's safe, I'd say there's no way I would do that. That would violate my fiduciary relationship to the patient. But doctors are not administering the COVID-19 vaccine in the current program. They're actually administered in vaccine centers. There's doctors' orders are not required for this. Patients can just go up and volunteer for this. So pregnant women need to understand that this isn't a doctor's decision that's occurring. And many leading doctors feel very strongly that pregnant women should not receive the COVID-19 vaccine. There's no proven benefit, and there's a great concern that the vaccine could cause harm to the baby or the mother.
Now, the other side of that argument is that the vaccine in a pregnant woman could be a good thing because antibodies could be passed down to the fetus.
Well, it is true that antibodies could pass to the fetus. They could also pass through the breast milk. But also, if antibodies can pass, then the dangerous spike protein can pass as well. We'd never want the baby to be exposed to the spike protein. We know it circulates for 2 weeks now. If that spike protein gets through the placenta and into fetal blood, we have no idea what type of damage is going to happen to the baby. And if it damages the heart, for instance, there's already reports that the spike protein damages the heart in young adults. If it's going to damage the heart in the baby and we're going to end up with pediatric heart failure or congenital malformations, this is a great concern. So this theoretical idea that antibodies pass to the baby, I think, is drowned out by the real possibility that the dangerous Wuhan spike protein, the gain of function spike protein designed for bioterrorism, is actually going to the babies. We do know of reports where women who have had a baby and now they're breastfeeding, where they take the vaccine and then the suckling baby through the breast milk it appears to be killed by the spike protein, that the spike protein is lethal to the baby, causing a blood disorder and death. That's putting together a clinical vignette. So I, in my analysis as a doctor, and I do see pregnant women in consultation, I see patients every day in my practice. After I finish here today, I'll go to the hospital and I'll see patients in my practice. I can tell you, I don't recommend this vaccine in pregnant women or in women who are breastfeeding. We have no data that it helps them, and we have great concern that it's harming the women and that it's potentially harming the baby or the fetus.
Then why are we doing this? Why are some people vaccinating pregnant women if it has this significant risk?
I think, my personal view is, I think our CDC, when they rolled out the vaccine program, should have had safety guardrails on it. I think it should have physician oversight. I think doctors should be deciding with patients. I don't think pregnant women should be allowed to receive the vaccine.
Are you concerned that these vaccines may become compulsory?
Well, I have great concern because I don't think the safety profile supports compulsory use. In fact, we don't have compulsory other vaccines. We know in the United States about 98% of Americans do accept all the standard vaccines: polio, diphtheria, pertussis, chicken pox, mumps, shingles, pneumococcal vaccines, influenza vaccines. We're about 90%, 98% pro-vax, if you will, in the United States. And there's about 2% of people who are skeptical, or their children have problems where they could have difficulties. And I can tell you, I have patients in my practice that have life-threatening reactions to vaccines, and they just simply can't take vaccines. And even the CDC for the COVID-19 vaccine said, listen, if patients have severe vaccine reactions, they shouldn't take the vaccine. So we know the COVID-19 vaccine is not going to be a needle in every arm. And now that we know that there are severe reactions, these patients can't get it, and also COVID recovered patients have higher vaccine reactions, that those patients shouldn't receive it. And I've told America that the COVID recovered patients, which is a huge swath of the population, in my clinical judgment, should not receive the vaccine. For those who think they've had COVID-19, but not sure, never got a test, they should get an antibody test or a T-cell test, a T-detect test, and see if they've had prior COVID. And if they have had prior COVID, again, that large group should not get the vaccine. We can't make the vaccine compulsory when there's really large groups that shouldn't get it. Again, pregnant women should not get it. Women of childbearing age shouldn't get it. COVID recovered shouldn't get it. Suspected COVID recovered proven with antibodies and T-cell tests shouldn't get it. Those with severe allergic reactions shouldn't get it. When we add those together, that's a large population. That could actually be about half of the remaining Americans. So as the vaccine programs have really dribbled to a low level, that may be appropriate. The vaccine program actually may be, in a sense, coming to a close naturally as we sit here today in the beginning of June 2021.
What are the dangers of being vaccinated after already having COVID-19?
Three studies show, two from the United Kingdom and one from New York, show higher rates of vaccine reactions. And shockingly, about 25% to a third of people seeking vaccination had already had COVID. So these are patients that we know can't get COVID twice. We know they have complete, durable, robust immunity. There's no reason to get a vaccine, but because of the messaging, they show up at vaccine centers and they take a vaccine. We know they have double to triple the rates of severe side effects. One paper showed patients winding up in the hospital. So here, I think it's clear, COVID recovered patients under no conditions should receive the COVID-19 vaccine. That's a clinical judgment, and the doctor's judgment takes priority over the NIH, CDC, and FDA.
We talked a little bit about the typical procedure, and you said that we are deviating from what you would expect our reaction to be in a crisis like this. Of course, this also begs the question as to why is this happening? Why are we doing this? And I'm going to have to ask you to speculate here, but why are we doing this?
Well, we could look at the surface and just say fairly that this viral pandemic created unprecedented amounts of fear among all citizens of all countries. The fear levels were unprecedented. People in lockdowns, can't leave their house, their workplaces were closed, enormous fear. In fact, people were trying to sterilize their groceries and sterilize delivered pizza trays and things like this. Initially, the fear levels were absolutely through the roof. You may recall, remember, there was a rush on toilet paper. People were going out to the store. They didn't know. They thought maybe it was a tsunami gonna wash across the world. The fear levels were unprecedented. And I think for the first time, doctors, nurses, hospitals, they had a fear of contamination. They had a fear of actually treating patients. And I think that initial fear is really what suppressed early treatment. People said, listen, we'll take care of it in the hospital if we have to, and we'll wear hazmat suits and put patients in isolation. But a clinic is an uncontrolled environment. So many doctors felt like, wow, this is too scary to handle in a clinic. So it took a lot of independent doctors, a lot of courageous doctors. People use the word courage all the time. And it really is the original innovators, Vladimir Zelenko in New York City, Stella Emanuel in Houston, Richard Urso. You know, I was doing it just as a doctor, as an internist and cardiologist, but I never really took on personal risk. I was doing it by telemedicine. I saw some patients afterwards. Maybe I did take some risks more than others. I did end up contracting the virus. And almost all the hero doctors that you hear in the media, Brian Tyson, for instance, George Farid, Ben Marble, we can go through the list. Heroes, they're really kind of popular heroes on social media. Almost all of us came down with the virus. Some of us got pretty sick and were hospitalized. So we did take our hits for really being on the front line. The front line is when a doctor literally faces a patient in an uncontrolled setting and tries to take care of them. The hospital really wasn't the front line since there was so many defenses there and there were no major hospital outbreaks. We heard of a sporadic cases of nurses getting in or doctors, but there wasn't a contagion. Where we did have problems with contagion control was in nursing homes. And it was multiple studies showed nursing home workers would get the virus and they'd typically be younger. They would be okay. And they'd give the virus to the seniors and it would be fatal. it would be absolutely fatal. And that became the greatest concern. So when we started looking at this, I said, listen, we've got to treat according to risk. Older individuals, seniors should be treated very aggressively. And when it came to vaccination, I said the very first people who should be vaccinated would be the nursing home workers. I wasn't so sure about the seniors because they're so frail. And we knew by the mechanism, this vaccine could be fatal in a frail senior. And in fact, that's what we've seen. A large number of the deaths are actually in the most susceptible for COVID, and that's the seniors. But we've had a great departure from the usual approach to, you know, treating this infection. We should have had large randomized trials. We left Americans with no treatment. People in the world, in fact, it was worse than that. When doctors tried to give treatment, those doctors were reprimanded. Their licenses were threatened. We've never seen this before. My license was never threatened if I try to take care of an asthmatic or take care of a patient with a staph infection. Why would my license be potentially threatened with an attempt to treat a COVID-19 patient? It was really unprecedented what's happened. I think people ought to be disturbed with this idea that, you know, it's almost as if there was a wave of things that all work to accomplish something. And that is promoting fear, promoting hospitalization and death and suffering. And it almost everything. And that, when I mentioned Steve Kirsch, he reached out to the FDA, CDC, NIH, and WHO. And he said, listen, I'll give you $2 million if you can show me one thing that any of these agencies did to treat patients and reduce this fear, suffering, hospitalization, and death. And not a single person has come forward for $2 million. That really should tell the people of the world, wait a minute, not a single effort to help a single patient in the most deadly pandemic of our time. It's really extraordinary.
So to be clear, doctors who were treating COVID-19 patients were at risk of losing their license?
Some have had their license suspended. They've gone through threats from medical boards. They've gone through reviews. They've had legal expenses. They've had their practices destroyed. They've lost their positions. So yes, doctors were actually penalized for trying to help patients, the first time in history. And helping patients with safe and effective drugs. Drugs became controversial for no reason. When I testified in the U.S. Senate, I remember holding up my protocol. And I was at the point where there's prednisone and steroids and aspirin and blood thinners. I said, I do this in my practice every day for other patients with other conditions. How can this be controversial? How can any doctor be penalized for using these common drugs, which we use every day?
Now, I'm in close communication for this worldwide disaster with many countries. And I can tell you, I did a program with Eamon Matheson and the COVID Medical Network in Australia to show you how off kilter the world is. In Queensland, Australia, a doctor will be put in jail for prescribing hydroxychloroquine. To show you how, I mean, if you go over to India, they're going to give it to you right away. In Greece, they're going to give it to you right. It's in their guidelines. In Greece,
it's over the counter in some countries.
But my point is, we're all the way from they give it first line in their guidelines. The Greek guidelines give hydroxychloroquine, but in Queensland, you get put in jail. In the United States, we're caught up in this flurry of data and confusion. Something is going very wrong in this world.
So common drugs that we use every day, suddenly when they're applied in a doctor's judgment to help a COVID patient, suddenly those conventional, accepted, proven, safe, effective drugs suddenly put that doctor's license at risk. It's very disturbing.
A lot of the viewers have questions about the spike protein shedding. There has been some information circulating that vaccinated people could possibly be shedding the spike protein, which is making a bystander ill. Is there any scientific merit for that?
Well, we know that in the Pfizer application that they expressed some concern in the protocol. So they wanted to know if a man got a vaccine and there was a pregnant woman in the house, what happened to the pregnant woman? We didn't hear any of the data in the Pfizer briefing booklet, but that expressed concern I thought was interesting. There are research studies published previously on the concept of like vaccinating one animal and having the animal through a lot of contact expose other animals to an antigen and getting them immune. That was published in bats and other mammals. The only direct evidence of shedding, we know the spike protein probably comes out in oral and and fecal and urogenital secretions. The only direct evidence, it looks like in some of these vignettes, again, where a breast feeding baby gets the spike protein through the breast milk and the baby is killed with a blood disorder afterwards. That's kind of the most direct shedding. But people are talking about it because there are reports, not substantiated, let's say among young women, that young women with menstrual irregularities having the vaccine in a sense kind of transmit that to other women. It's purely conjecture. I personally don't think that's very tractable, but we're going to have to follow the data there. Shedding, because we've never had a vaccine that produces an uncontrolled production of a pathogenic protein in the human body before. We've never done that. The possibilities are endless of what's going to happen in terms of shedding, organ injury, long-term injury. We're really in the great unknown here.
So, Dr. McCullough, I have to ask you, is it accurate to say that this COVID-19 gene-based vaccine is safe?
I think every doctor's view of the COVID-19 vaccines, because they're a group of products, really has to be evidence-based and based on the data and ought to be dynamic and contemporary with respect to time. So as these products came out of the registrational trials, they did look safe and effective, albeit there were very low rates of COVID. So the vaccines were tested in people, 99% of whom never were going to get COVID. So we didn't have confidence that they were going to protect against disease or reduce spread, but they looked reasonable. And as the data started to come out, and you know, 70% of my patients in my internal medicine cardiology practice have received the vaccine. I've had large numbers of family members receive the vaccine. I'm very pro-vaccine. I've received all the evidence-based vaccines. But as I've seen the data come out, my patients, my family members vaccinated December, January, February, that's before there was a catch-up in the data. Now that we have over 4,400 deaths, over 14,000 hospitalizations reported in a vaccine safety database, which are unprecedented numbers. We typically, for all the vaccines combined, we typically get 200 across many hundreds of millions of shots, 200 deaths, suddenly 4,400 deaths. I don't think anybody can argue that is a giant spike in deaths. My concern over vaccine safety has progressively become more intense. As we sit here today, I think we're at the point where the vaccine program can be brought down. It can be either phased out or paused. I think largely the number of people who are very fearful of COVID-19, they've received the vaccine. Early treatment has basically squashed these epidemic curves. We know the vaccine will not impact the epidemic curves. It's not going to impact COVID-19 in the United States. It may help individuals who are fearful, I think, become a little bit more courageous in terms of their activities. That's a side benefit of the vaccine. But we have enough safety concern at this point in time. It's clearly on a case-by-case basis. So when I go to the hospital today, if my next patient asks me, doctor, should I get the COVID-19 vaccine? I'm going to take it on a case-by-case basis. If you ask me, Dr. McCullough, is the vaccine generally safe? Is it safe enough for people just to walk up and get the vaccine right now? My answer is no, it's not generally safe. We have enough concerns on safety. As we sit here today, there are multiple papers and multiple action letters coming in from societies all over the world asking regulatory authorities to go ahead and shut down the program. And I'm not alone in my concern in safety. There are many tens of thousands of signatories on multiple documents worldwide, and they've gone into the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, European Medical Association, and to the WHO, all of them saying, listen, if we can't get transparency on safety, can't get these events analyzed, and can't come up with risk mitigation, that is an approach to make the program safer. Americans have heard nothing about risk mitigation and making the program safer, then I think we ought to go ahead and shut it down.
Let's talk a little bit about medical ethics here. Are you concerned about the level of coercion to receive this vaccine from, say, the media and politicians?
Medical ethicists would say that no patient in any medical decision should receive pressure coercion or the threat of reprisal. Patients can get information with their doctor or healthcare provider. That's the fiduciary relationship. But no doctor can pressure a patient to take a medicine or take an injection. And certainly nobody outside that doctor-patient relationship can ever pressure or coerce or create reprisal for this. So yes, ethicists and myself have great concerns for what's going on. You can imagine an individual thinking that they could win $1 million in a lottery, but yet if they take the vaccine, they could die in the next 3 days. What an incredibly difficult, tense choice, being coerced or seduced by money, and then in a sense, dying after an injection. The tension among parents right now and the college kids is enormous. You know, well-educated families are saying, listen, this COVID-19 vaccine has got some problems. And to have a college-age kid who has no benefit of getting the vaccine to be vaccinated when they're not making the faculty get vaccinated, to have the child take all that risk. The estimates are if we have 20 million kids going off to college right now in the United States, that we're going to end up with probably 80 fatalities in that group. It'll be 80 kids lost and 1,000 hospitalized. The tension is so heavy right now in America based on this ethical situation that we should never have gotten into. Coercion should be against the law. We should not ever have a lottery or a raffle. We should never have somebody's employment be based on taking an investigational vaccine, someone's education threatened, their social situation threatened. You know, these levels, coercion and pressure and threat of reprisal, that's what ought to be made illegal.
Doctor, are we being reckless?
I think our government agencies at this point in time can be characterized as committing malfeasance. And that's wrongdoing by those in position of authority. And I think that challenge by Steve Kirsch, who's a real leader in early treatment, to say, listen, show us anything that you've done right. And there's not a single person at any agency that they themselves think that they have done right. If it is uniform now, every patient ever denied hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or steroids or aspirin or Lovenox or prednisone, these patients who are denied early treatment, that's malfeasance. It's wrongdoing by those who are working to prevent early treatment. It's malfeasance for a patient to have coercion to receive a vaccine and then have a fatal reaction. That's out of bounds. That would be considered reckless endangerment. In the U.S. Senate testimony, I was the lead witness for the majority chairman, but we had a minority witness. We had a media doctor who gave advice over the course of 2 hours, and then it came out. He's giving advice for America, actually, on treatment. And it came out through the questioning that he had never seen and examined a patient with COVID-19. And his recommendation was, don't treat it. Just go ahead and die or be hospitalized. That was his recommendation. And my comment, I put it into Senate testimony. I thought that recommendation was reckless. So he is a position of authority. I'm in a position of authority. And our relationship to the nation is one of beneficence, meaning that we should be making decisions and making statements that's in the best interest of the people. For that minority witness to recommend no treatment is reckless. No treatment can only lead to bad outcomes.
Before we conclude, is there anything else you would like to add or share with the viewers?
I just ask Americans and people all over the world to do just a check in their minds of what's going on and have them recognize, and you've done a wonderful job today of identifying these points of departure. We have departed now so far from safe, conventional, good medical practice. What's going on is not good medical practice to deny patients early treatment, to deny patients in the hospital medicines that families want to see administered, like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and then to promote and push and coerce and pressure and threaten the administration of a vaccine that has unprecedented numbers of deaths and hospitalizations afterward. All of that should be bundled into a bundle that creates a disturbia. There should be a mental sense of being disturbed about this. I'm personally disturbed about this. When I go into the hospital today, I'm going to again look at things and just ask myself, are things normal? or have things gotten into some situation that is disturbing? And if it's disturbing now, I can tell you it's probably going to get worse.
Dr. Peter McCullough, thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you all for watching this video. As I always say, share it with your friends and your family and all over your social media. And while you're at it, don't forget to subscribe to The Last American Vagabond. I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and I'll see you guys next time.